All right, you guys, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I already said that, I know, but I'm saying it again. Welcome to the thing here. I got a good one for you today. Our friend Mel Freichberg will be back on the show. Remember her from Interpress Service and I guess sometimes the Christian Science Monitor and McClatchy Newspapers. Here she is at McClatchy writing about Libya. So Mel will be back on the show. And then we're picking up our series with Michael Swanson at part two. It'll be part two of our interview with Michael Swanson about his great book, The War State. And of course, Mike has been a great sponsor of this show for the last year and a bit more. He runs the Wall Street Window there. Investment advice. He's not trying to be your broker or anything. He's just trying to show you how he does it. That's all. It's a good thing over there. Go check it out. WallStreetWindow.com. And then this book, I think it's great. I've got no conflict of interest whatsoever here, man, in promoting this thing. Or I guess I do, but it's completely irrelevant. You understand? That's what I mean. The War State by Michael Swanson. It's red, and it's got Ike on the front, and it says The War State in really big white letters, and you should probably purchase it, you know, and then read it. It's a really quick read, too. You'll blaze right through it and think to yourself, wow, I just sat down and read 100 pages in no time flat. Didn't even have to get up and go to the bathroom. You'll plow right through it, and then you'll be smarter in your brain. You'll know more things than you used to know, and about really important stuff like, you know, the form of the war state. Great stuff. So I'm going to be talking with him, too. It'll be part two. Coming up on the show. And also, I got a bunch of news to cover. In fact, I have so much news I couldn't possibly get through what all I need to talk with you about in the first half hour of the show here. Now, I'm going to try. First of all, I got to tell you, in case you're not aware, that you know, all the war state notwithstanding, the reason that September 11th happened to America, you know, September 11th being the reason, so-called, for everything the American government has chosen to do since then, in the name of reacting to it, if not actually in reaction to it. The reason that that horrible event took place, 3,000 killed, people smashed and burned to death and jumping, you know, having to choose between jumping out of a building or burning and this kind of horror. Well, that nightmare took place mostly because of American support for Israel. Now, if Israel was just a bunch of nice guys and, you know, well, obviously the terrorists are a bunch of bad guys, but if they were targeting us simply because we were doing the right thing and being friends with some guys who were some really good friends to us too and whatever, then I guess that would be one thing. But really, the reason that they attacked the United States is not because Israel's a bunch of nice guys sitting there, sleeping giant and all of that. And it's not because necessarily that they're genocidal maniacs who want to drive them all into the sea. It's certainly not the Israelis, that is. It's certainly not the situation they're reacting to, just the existence of Israel. What it is to this day, in great measure, is American support for Israel's war crimes. For Israel's apartheid domination of the Palestinians. You know, the West Bank, that's not Israeli territory. That's occupied territory where the Palestinians live. And East Jerusalem, why, that's just a half a city in the middle of being stolen. As all 7 billion people in the world could tell you. Never mind the West, they already took that. But anyway, I'm being specific now. I'm not just saying, geez, you know, American support for Israel causes resentment in the Muslim world. But no, specifically, Mohammed Atta, who was the head hijacker, the organizer of the Al-Qaeda cell in the United States that carried out the 9/11 attack, He wrote out his last will and testament during the Israeli invasion, well, crackdown, I guess, in Operation Grapes of Wrath in southern Lebanon in 1996. And just like American soldiers who joined up the army after September 11th, he saw that as his September 11th, you know, or bad analogy since he's the guy who did September 11th, but you see what I mean. It was an attack against people that he identified with, and so he joined up as a soldier on their side against us. And in fact, if you go back and look at Osama bin Laden's so-called fatwas, not that he had enough religious rank to issue a fatwa, but anyway, his argument was that the responsible imams won't do it, so he was taking their place. Anyway, I'm not saying that's legit, I'm just saying that's what he said. But you'll hear critics say, oh yeah, Osama bin Laden, he doesn't care about Israel, he never cared about Israel, he's a Johnny-come-lately to the Israel issue just because he thinks it's good PR and whatever, which first of all, if that was true, then what does that tell you? That he thinks that it's good PR? To pretend to care about the Palestinians? Well, why is that good PR? Because anybody else does? Or what? But meanwhile, if you just go to the NewsHour website, PBS NewsHour, U.S. State TV, if you just go and look, they have on their website the Declaration of War against the Jews and Crusaders, a.k.a. the Declaration of War against the Americans occupying the land of the two holy places. Or I guess maybe the first one's 96 and the second one is the 98 title. But anyway, he goes on and on and on and on and on about Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon too. And in fact, in 1996, that was when Bill Clinton arranged with the Sudanese for them to, instead of arresting the guy and handing him over to the U.S., he arranged for them to kick him out of the country. So they did. They kicked him out of the country. They sent him off to Afghanistan. I guess the theory being, not, well, geez, we'll never be able to reach him there, but he won't be able to reach us from there. Yeah, Bill Clinton, what a great leader. Anyway, so this was just after he arrived in Afghanistan. He put out this declaration of war, and it was just, well, I guess 2 or 3 months after the first Qana massacre. That's Q-A-N-A. And don't get confused with the Qana massacre of 2006. That's different. Same perpetrators, same victims, but, you know, not individually. But in 1996, there was the Qana massacre where a bunch of women and children were killed there in southern Lebanon, and that featured prominently in bin Laden's original declaration of war. So, I'm not saying that he was in the right or that anything that he did was justified or excused. I'm just saying that was the reason he did it. And in fact, if you read Perfect Soldiers, which I don't know if he won a Pulitzer for that thing or something, but it's really good. I have to assume it's an award-winning piece of work by LA Times reporter Terry McDermott. And he's not being scandalous about this or focusing on it or anything. It just kind of comes up in the story because, hey, it's the story of the Hamburg cell. It's the story of the ringleader pilot hijackers. Well, most of them. Two of them were from a different group. But anyway, it's mostly a biography of the Hamburg cell of the 9/11 hijackers. Perfect Soldiers is what it's called. And there it is. Yeah, after they leave the mosque, they go back to their apartment and sit around talking about how much America should have to pay for what Israel did today. And that's because the Americans do pay for what Israel does today and yesterday and the day after tomorrow, too. It's not some, you know, mystery to the Palestinians or the Lebanese when they see F-16s and M-16s pointed at their heads. They know where this technology comes from. They know what this is. And so in both ways, we do pay for our support for Israel. And the fact of the matter is, and you know, I'm only just into the book, so this isn't, don't consider this some kind of full-fledged critique of Blumenthal's book. I'm reading Max Blumenthal's book about Israel right now. And I don't know if I'm trying to, you know, reassess a little bit my thinking on this or whatever. I don't think it needs to budge very far. Of course, he's right. Anyone who says, who agrees with him, is right to say that the original sin is the Nakba, that Israel was created through a horrible crime against the people who already lived there. And that, you know, poisons everything from here on and whatever. Now, again, I'm not all the way through the book, and yeah. And then supposedly the other side of that argument from the liberal Zionist point of view would be that, well, you know, it would be okay if they would just give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, that the real sin is the occupation starting in 67. And now my thing is this. I think they're both partly right. I think that, yeah, of course, the whole original sin here was creating a colony, an imperialist colony in the era after World War II when that kind of thing is over, man. It was a bad idea in the first place. Should have given them the best part of Germany. So, yeah, and then, of course, the crime of the Nakba is legendary. It ranks up there with the Trail of Tears and whatever you want. However, the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in East Jerusalem, well, that's a whole other thing and way worse. And that's the thing that if they would just knock it off, which they could, they wouldn't be giving up of any of the land that they quote-unquote won since the end of World War II. Just the land that they're occupying, militarily occupying, and not really claiming is theirs. I mean, it's sort of kind of the spoil of wars, but it's recognized to be Palestinian land. That's why it's Area C, as well as our security zone on their property, because of necessity, whatever. But so, in other words, what I'm saying is, I think that if they did just give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, and they wouldn't even have to be, at this point, they wouldn't even have, at that point, they wouldn't even have to be honest about the crime of the Nakba or anything. They could just say, look, we gave up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That's the Saudi peace plan anyway. The leaders of all the Arab states, the bribed and the not so bribed, have pretty much all agreed to that. Hamas even has agreed to that all along. They said on the freaking Charlie Rose show on Channel 9 that, yeah, of course we'll recognize Israel within 67 borders. Just give us the measly, stinking Gaza Strip and West Bank. We'll settle. That's actually been the Palestinian position since 1988. And then, you know, I think of Israel as just the Jim Crow South. I know it sounds silly to think of a bunch of Jews as a bunch of right-wing, redneck, American Southerners. But yeah, that's pretty much how it is. It's the Jim Crow South. Only, you know, if the Jim Crow South was occupying part of Mexico militarily, too. On the other side of the border, if you feel what I mean there. But inside Israel, yeah, it's, you know, I don't like it. I think their whole must be Jewish and democratic blah blah scenario, I don't think really is working out very well for the long term, but at least they would have a decent shot at it. And I'm saying, go by their rules, not what I would have. I would have a stateless society there and then liberty, and then it wouldn't matter which sect anyone was from, except nobody agrees with me about that, so I'll just skip it. But anyway, the point being that Israel and their criminal occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Yes, they have withdrawn from southern Lebanon, but then again, like I was saying, they go back from time to time, like in 06, and kill a bunch of people. And this is a problem for the United States. You could ask General Mattis. You could ask General Petraeus. They are both on the record saying American support for Israel undermines our position in the Middle East. And in fact, Petraeus' statement was much more specific about this puts his soldiers at risk. In other words, Americans die because of what Israel does. In fact, blam, I got an important factoid that I got to mention here that comes out of my brain via Ray McGovern, who pointed out on the show. Remember now the giant riot in Fallujah where they strung up the Blackwater guys? And then this was the biggest deal in the world, right? Because what ended up happening was the Americans attacked Fallujah in revenge, and a bunch of Sunnis were flushed out of the Anbar province and out of Fallujah, where they went to Baghdad, where they went to go stay with their Sunni neighbors. And That ended up, and it was a pretty big, large influx of people, and that ended up displacing some Shiites. And that was the real start of the sectarian war in Iraq. I mean, it's sort of been a tinderbox waiting to explode, I guess. But that was what really did it, was Bush's attack on Fallujah, which was revenge for the Blackwater guards hanging from the bridge. Well, what caused that? It was the Israeli assassination of Yassin, who the Mossad had helped Yassin build Hamas in the first place as a right-wing religious moral counterweight to the at least so-called secular commie PLO. Much more secular commie, I guess. So it was Israel that deliberately worked with Yassin to create Hamas in the first place. Well, they assassinated him. He was a helpless old man in a wheelchair at that point. They could have just walked up to him and arrested him if they wanted to. But they killed him in a missile strike, and that's what caused the riot in Fallujah. And that's what led to the tit-for-tat back and forth till it became the full-scale sectarian cleansing civil war that killed somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Iraqis during the late war there, which actually continues to this day, pardon me. It's a funny thing about, you know, actions and consequences and stuff like that. Oh, except it's not funny. It's horrifying. It's terrible. Think about that Iraq war. All right. Anyway, Mohammed Atta and bin Laden agreed. The Americans have to pay for what they do for Israel, to help Israel in their criminal occupation, their murderous totalitarian occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And here's the thing, and of course there are occasional murder sprees in Lebanon. Also, you should really understand about the Gaza Strip that it's really just a big concentration camp. And I don't mean it's a death camp, like the worst of the Holocaust, but it is a concentration camp. I mean, that's what the term concentration camp means. Concentrate a bunch of people who are all alike together in one place and whatever. Hamas doesn't really rule Gaza. The Israeli government rules Gaza. And what they did was they withdrew the last of the settlers out of there, and that, which I guess the Palestinians had wanted, but it backfired because those Jewish settlers in Gaza were basically sort of human shields, preventing the worst of the government crackdown against the Palestinians who live there, who, you know, it's almost entirely their land. So anyway, now that their human, Jewish shields are gone, the fact that a majority of them are minors, get it? A majority of the people of the Gaza Strip are under the age of 18. And that doesn't protect them from the Israeli blockade, which the WikiLeaks, thank you, Chelsea Manning, the WikiLeaks reveal the Israelis talking about how their policy is deliberately to keep the children of the Gaza Strip hungry but not starving. On a diet. Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at ListenandThink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out ListenandThink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at ListenandThink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This here is my show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 now, going back to 2003, believe it or not. At ScottHorton.org. And check out the chat room. Join up. Say hi to the boys and girls in there. Might be just boys today. Anyway, Go in there and say hey. ScottHorton.org/chat. You can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. So, anyway, enough about Israel-Palestine. Other than just, it ain't personal. I sure ain't no bigot of any kind or anything like that. And I know how, I was raised on American media too. The presumption is if you got something bad to say about Israel, it's because you really just don't like Jews and that's your secret code word for Jew bashing or whatever. But really? Then explain Max Blumenthal to me. Every Jew I know hates Israel. All of them, including my wife. Because Israel is a right-wing nationalist expansionist war state. Full of a bunch of bigots. It's like the Jim Crow South, only on the Eastern Mediterranean. What's to like? Oh yeah, and also, the Iraq War was an Israeli intelligence op against the United States. Only what was funny was they were the ones getting bent over and completely screwed by Ahmed Chalabi and the Iranians the whole time. Hey Scott, how did America get in the Iraq War anyway? Well, you see, the Ayatollah Khamenei sent Ahmed Chalabi to tell the neoconservatives that the future Shiite Iraq would be good for Israel. And they bought it because they're stupid. So I'm sorry, but that's why your cousin has no legs now. And then look at the Iran headlines today. Almost threw my shoe through the TV here. Although I'm happy to see ABC News bothering to cover it, man. That's kind of a news story in itself. It's the Associated Press, but ABC News ran it on their website, so I'm giving them credit. I think that's sort of an astounding kind of a fact itself. The story is signs of a rift between Israel and U.S. over Iran. And now they don't say it in plain English. The Israelis are trying to undermine the American president's attempt to make a nuclear deal with the Iranians. On their behalf. It's all for them anyway. It's their ridiculous lie that the Iranians are making nukes in the first place. Everybody knows that. It's Benjamin Netanyahu's besweated terror as he pees in his pants and throws a little temper tantrum over a little bit of industrial-grade uranium that you couldn't even make a bomb out of. That's all safeguarded by the IAEA anyway. That's the big fake controversy in the first place. And now the Americans want to double extra super duper verify that it's not being used to make a bomb. And all the Israelis can do is try to undermine that and try to keep tensions high. Await the day where Jeb Bush or someone comes to give them the regime change they need so bad. What does it take to get 300 million Americans to tell Israel to, if not piss off, how about just sit down and shut up? Are you kidding me? Where it's not even a secret. Our policy is to undermine these peace talks. Oh yeah? Well, go to hell and stay there. Meanwhile, everyone who's not the right-wing nationalist expansionist government of Israel, it's the worst thing you can say about them, obviously. I was going to call them criminals, but I figured I'd just call them a government. What was I going to say now? Something about how they annoy the hell out of me. Something about how, hey, how about this to talk about on this subject? The Anti-Defamation League has given this show's sponsor and this show's friend, Philip Giraldi, and his organization, the Council for the National Interest, which it's not his organization, he's the executive director of it now, the Council for the National Interest, they got fifth place in very worst, most anti-Israel organizations in America. Isn't that great? And check out the list. The first is the Communists Answer, which, why are they first on the list? They don't even do anything anymore at all. Whoever even heard of them since Bush left town? American Muslims for Palestine, Code Pink, Friends of Sabil, North America, and then If Americans Knew, / Council for the National Interest, founded by Pete McCloskey and them, run by Phil Giraldi, sponsors of this show. They got fifth place for Best on Israel, the Best on Israel-Palestine Award from the ADL. I mean, that's what they meant. And then I love this too, Jewish Voice for Peace. Yeah, these are all groups who just hate Jews, especially the Jewish Voice for Peace. Doesn't that sound like an anti-Semitic neo-Nazi front to you? Anyway. So then, you know, I posted that and someone asked on my Facebook page, hey, can't you be pro-Israel and pro-Palestine? And my answer to that is, yeah. I think Max Blumenthal, he'll be on the show as soon as I finally get this book read and interview him about it. I think he's going to dispute that or something. But like I say, I believe that, yes, the answer is that if you had libertarians running Israel and they just gave up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and repealed almost everything and had a free society there, then everything would be fine. These things have a way of working themselves out on the market, you know? But anyway, and you know, Colin Powell and all them said that my interpretation is correct. Colin Powell told George Bush, now's our chance. We've got to make the Israelis give up the West Bank and Gaza Strip and make a Palestinian state. We got all this political capital, Mr. President. We've got to do it. And then Tom DeLay came to town and said, only if you want to be a one-term president. And Bush backed down to Tom DeLay, a.k.a. Ariel Sharon's little sock puppet. And, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, the primary architect of the Iraq War, whose name will be associated with that for the rest of human history, as the primary architect of the Iraq War, he told Vanity Fair when he was riding high on his big success in the spring of 2003, that one of the reasons that they did the Iraq War was because they needed to get the bases out of Saudi Arabia, which was a big cause of the September 11th attack against the United States. So there you go. That's why they did it in the first place, because of American support for Israel and because America following Israel's policy in enforcing dual containment on Iraq and Iran from Saudi Arabia in the 1990s. The cause of what ails you? The government in Jerusalem.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. More than 3,000 interviews in the archives now at scotthorton.org. Drop by scotthorton.org. And also check me out on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. Okay, our first guest today is Mel Freichberg. She writes for McClatchyDC.com, well, McClatchy Newspapers at McClatchyDC.com. And right now, I believe, is reporting from the West Bank, correct? Hi, Mel. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
And am I right? You're in the West Bank right now or on it?
Yes, I am. I'm in Ramallah.
In Ramallah, okay. And then do I have it right that you've been to Libya lately or you're talking with stringers there?
I'm talking with forces on the ground there and with friends that are there.
Okay. And I know you were there, what, a few months back, right?
I was there, yeah, I was there last year.
Okay. Okay, so almost a year ago then. All right. Well, so first of all, before we even get into the kidnapping, can you tell us what you know about the president of Libya who was kidnapped for a short time a couple of weeks back there?
Yes, he's the prime minister.
Oh, the prime minister.
Information. Yeah. Ali Zaidan saying that two members of the Libyan Congress were behind his kidnapping. And a member of the counter-criminal agency was involved in the kidnapping as well. And when they actually kidnapped him, they took his phone away from him. And his phone was later discovered in the General National Congress building because the whole mystery behind his kidnapping of how they'd been able to get him in the Corinthia Hotel, which I visited. And for those kidnappers to get through the security was very strange that they'd managed to get through all that security, and apparently his actual security detail didn't try to stop the kidnapping because they understood it to be an official arrest, and he was actually held at the Interior Ministry. So that just goes to show how little security is in Libya and how much infighting there is between members of the government.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I mean, was he actually, in a way, legally arrested for a crime and then he was set free? Or that was just the glossing that they put on an attempted coup?
No. There's been some political dispute. And, I mean, he's committed no crime. But these members of the Congress, that it was all unofficial. But they dissatisfied with his rule as premier. And they sort of thought that he maybe had something to do with the abduction of that Al-Qaeda suspect, Anas Abu Libi, who was taken by the Navy SEAL team, by the U.S. Special Forces. Mm-hmm. That was one issue that they were dissatisfied, because these guys that from the Libyan government are suspected Islamist sympathizers, but also they're dissatisfied with his rule.
Right. Well, so, I mean, how badly did that reflect on him for that Delta Force raid happening on his watch? Is it clear, do you think, over there that he had given the Americans permission to do it? I think that's at least what the Americans claimed, right?
They say that the Libyan government was aware of what was happening. The Libyan government denies it. Rumors are that they knew, the Libyan government knew about it, but they would pretend that they didn't know about it, and then they would protest very loudly after it happened, so as for domestic consumption that they hadn't, that they didn't know about it. That's what the rumors are. But I mean, just the fact that he was able to get through all that security, because I mean, I've been to the Corinthia Hotel, and I mean, there's police cars patrolling the hotel. Before you can even get into the hotel, there's a big, you know, you have to go through all these metal detectors, there's security guards inside the hotel. Even getting into the parking lot, there's a military checkpoint there, and there's military police 3 minutes away. So, you know, just the way that they were able to get through all this and nothing happened, it was very suspicious. The two members of Congress have denied that they were involved in it, but the member from the counter-criminal agency, he said, yes, he was involved and he's very proud of it. So, yeah, there's a lot of strange things happening in Libya.
Mm. And just to clarify for the audience, this is not the al-Libi that was tortured into pointing the finger at Saddam Hussein for cooperating with al-Qaeda, and it's not the al-Libi that they killed in Pakistan in June 2012 that was the reason behind the attack on the Benghazi consulate back in September 11, 2012. This would be a third and altogether separate al-Libi. And I believe those first two were brothers, supposedly, but this is an entirely different character accused in, I think, as you said, the Africa embassy bombings in 1998.
Yeah.
But then they brought him, they kidnapped him and kept him on a ship at sea for a little while, apparently kind of black hole lawless territory, but then they brought him back to New York, where I guess he'd already been indicted, and now they're going to put him on trial. So that's pretty good, right? Instead of taking him to Morocco to be tortured or Guantanamo Bay to be held forever?
Well, the thing is, according to him, he had actually, and according to his family, he'd actually left al-Qaeda in 96, or was it 95, and he'd actually asked for political asylum in Britain, which he had received. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's like quite an old fish. And
right.
So they're saying that he probably didn't have anything to do with anything after that, but I'm not sure.
Well, I don't mean to be too cynical, but I wonder if the Americans are just trying to provoke a reaction and he was a good target for that.
Possibly.
I see a big buildup in Italy, and they're saying, well, we got problems to solve here. I'm sorry, you're a straight reporter. I'm not trying to lead you down into rabbit hole territory here. So let's go to what life is like in Tripoli and in Benghazi and in the rest of Libya right now. Is it just Mad Max over there, or does the government have a... Is there a relative calm?
Well, Benghazi is an absolute mess. They've had over 100 military and judicial officials assassinated since the overthrow of Gaddafi. Every week, practically almost every day, actually, there's another military or judicial official assassinated. And they're not sure if, you know, they've said that somebody has a list of all these names of people that they want to assassinate. And there's now seems to be a war between members of, it seems that there's different militias that are behind the assassinations, and it's divided between those that are supporting, that are Islamist-leaning militia leaders, and the others who are against the Islamists. The military police, the head of the military police was killed a couple of days ago, and then militiamen who were supporting him then went and attacked the leader of the Libya Shield movement. And so these two sides have been trying to kill the different leaders, and there doesn't seem to be anybody who's able to stop these assassinations. And the different foreign embassies or consulates that have been attacked in Benghazi. The Swedish one was attacked a couple of weeks ago with a bomb. Mm-hmm. Then the Maltese consul was warned that his life was in danger, so he left Benghazi and he left Libya. And, of course, the French consul was attacked several months ago as well. So Benghazi is really out of control. There's stuff happening in Tripoli as well, but it's not as serious as Benghazi.
Mm-hmm. Well, and don't get me wrong, it's not like building a state is the definition of peace to me or anything, but it's an indication that, you know, there's a lack of war going on. I mean, if there's militias fighting each other over, you know, local spoils, I guess that's kind of one thing, but if there's... You know, if it breaks out into some kind of sectarian war or tribal war, that is a whole other level of violence. And I don't think you're saying we're there, right?
Well, these different tribes are supporting different leaders. There's different tribes that are supporting some of the Islamists, and different tribes that are supporting some of the leaders, the militia leaders who are against the Islamists. I mean, Ali Zaidan himself said Libya is not a functioning state in the sense of the word. He himself has said that. So I don't know what's going to happen. It just seems endless in Libya.
Well, you know, I was talking with Patrick Coburn the other day, and he was remarking about the media and the professional political class, all the pundits and whatever who got us into this thing, and how remarkable it is that they can just completely ignore it. And then I was explaining how my fear is they'll start paying attention to it, and they'll say that, you know what, I mean, they don't even need a boogeyman as bad as Gaddafi. They might just point at general chaos and say that only we can help and go in there and start trying to make it better, which, of course, would just make it worse, but that's okay. Then there's just more to do.
I think NATO has said recently that they're going to help the Libyans with security. So I don't know how that'll work out. It just points very badly for what will happen in Syria when you see what a mess Libya is. And Syria is going to be an even bigger mess. So, you know, with the Americans getting involved there.
Well, now, when we hear about the different Islamist militias in Libya, are they kind of going crazy like Saudis and cutting people's hands off and trying to, you know, we saw, for example, Al-Qaeda in Iraq a lot of times would try to enforce, you know, centuries-old, real backwards ways on people, that kind of thing. Are we seeing that sort of extremism, or just they're fighting over power?
No, but what they have been doing is the assassinations and the bombings. They haven't been cutting hands off per se. Mm-hmm. But don't forget, when I was in Tripoli, the Tripolis were behind a lot of attacks on Sufi shrines, where they would just blow up these different, you know, these centuries-old, very beautiful buildings with, you know, books going back centuries from Sufi scholars, and they were sort of destroying graveyards, shrines, etc. So, and there were cases where they were actually going around enforcing women to cover their hair. And I think it was just a couple, was it today or yesterday, a woman's beautician shop in Benghazi was attacked. They've had a couple of cases of it, like in Gaza, where salons and beautician shops are attacked by Islamists because they see them as sort of corrupt and Western. But I'm not aware of chopping of hands from what I've heard. I heard about that.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I didn't mean to imply that I had read that anywhere either. I just, I wonder about, you know, because obviously in Syria and in Iraq, we've got some reports of some pretty extreme things, you know, the banning of smoking and just, you know, pretty totalitarian ways. And in fact, really the kind of things that turn the locals against them pretty fast, as we saw in Iraq. They overreached really quickly as far as their authority over the Sunni population of Iraq, and they paid for it, too.
Yeah, well, that's one of the problems in Benghazi, is that that there are a lot of Islamists there, but also the general population is against the Islamists, as we saw, you know, when Chris Stevens was killed. There was, you know, big protest against against the killing. So the that's also an element with the militias, and probably playing into the assassinations that are going on with, as I said, over 100 military and judicial assassinated, leaders assassinated.
Mm. And now, I guess I'm curious, can you describe it all? Do you know how deeply integrated groups like Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and others are into the actual government in Tripoli? Because I remember, and this could be wrong, but there were at least some reports from the attack on the oil facility in Algeria that the clothing and the weaponry that the, you know, quote-unquote terrorists had there came from the Libyan government.
I know that there are definitely members that are sympathetic to the Islamists, but a lot of the weapons that are coming from Libya and are flooding different areas like Mali, they're even coming into Egypt and they're reaching Gaza as well, are not officially from the Libyan government. Although there are members, as I say, of the government that are sympathetic. A lot of them is just, a lot of the weapons is just are very illegal. Right. Although I also seem to remember the Libyan government is giving a lot of money to the Syrian rebels. They were giving a huge amount of money to the Syrian rebels. So it's to know exactly who's doing what there, it's just very unclear.
Mm. And then, do you know anything of the fate of the blacks? Because, I don't mean that in the politically correct way, the blacks, but I mean the blacks of Libya, because apparently the war was fought for the Libyan branch of the Ku Klux Klan, and they had gone, at least back in 2011, we heard some horror stories about what was happening to darker-skinned Africans in Libya, yes. And then the journalism on that subject has just completely fallen off.
It was, I know when I was there and I was visiting some Tuaregans who come from that city of you know, black-skinned Libyans who allegedly were, you know, fighting with Gaddafi. And one doesn't know whether they were pressured into fighting with Gaddafi or whether they generally sympathized with him. But that town of Tuarega was just totally destroyed and ethnically cleansed of Tuaregans. And they had subsequently fled to refugee camps in Tripoli and elsewhere. And a lot of them, when I went to the refugee camps there, they were actually scared to walk in to leave the refugee camps and go around Tripoli because they would be picked up by these different militias. There was a very, very strong anti-black African sentiment from certain sections of the revolutionaries in that. But while I was in Tripoli as well, I also saw a lot of the militia guys themselves were actually dark-skinned Libyans, and you know, I would basically see, you know, dark-skinned Libyans in the street married to lighter-skinned Libyans. Again, it was just from, it's not correct to say all Libyans were against them, but there was certainly a section who, especially from Misrata, because there was a lot of problems between Misrata and Tuaregan, and I know the Misrata militias were very instrumental in a lot of the atrocities carried out against darker-skinned Libyans. Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you think it's sort of died down since then, at least.
It hasn't made the news a lot since then, and I haven't heard the human rights organizations saying a lot about it. So maybe there has been some improvement, or maybe people have just, I don't know, got so tired of Libya being such a mess, and there's so much trouble going on there, and they're now focusing on what's going on with Syria. So I'm not 100% certain.
Right. Yeah, on to the next war. And on to the next one. All right. Well, and speaking of which, let's talk about what's going on in the Sinai. You got some great journalism about Egypt's renewed military dictatorship's crackdown there.
Yeah, they it's the largest ground offensive in the Sinai. The largest Egyptian domestic offensive since the 1973 war with Egypt. The military is still carrying on with large-scale, you know, bombings and arrests. But exactly what is going on is hard to know because the Egyptian military is like cracking it down on foreign journalists. Foreign journalists are not allowed to go to the area, and even Egyptian journalists are struggling to get in. So it's very it's very difficult to know exactly what is going on, but human rights organizations say the stuff is leaking out is that the Egyptian military is carrying out some atrocities. They are indiscriminately targeting people on occasion. They've arrested hundreds and hundreds of people. But as I say, exactly what is going on, because some, you know, even some foreigners who've been caught in the area, and because they've had a laptop on them and a map on them, which is fairly normal stuff to have if you're a journalist, they've been arrested. So the operations are continuing, but they're not stopping these people in the Sinai. These people in the Sinai are really, really angry, and they're carrying out more attacks against the Egyptian military. So that's another situation that doesn't seem that's going to be solved by force alone.
And now, so what is it with them? That just happens to be a stronghold of strong Muslim Brotherhood support, or someone else?
They are strong Muslim Brotherhood supporters because not all of them, but what has happened is that the current Egyptian government, a military installed in government, has alienated a lot of the tribes in the Sinai. When Mubarak was in power, Hosni Mubarak, he withheld a lot of privileges and power from the Sinai people. They weren't politically involved, and they were also very deprived economically. So they began They were against the Hosni Mubarak's regime, and they became smuggling for economic reasons, and they also felt very politically cut off from Cairo. And of course, Mubarak's security forces was very brutal against the people in the Sinai, and that alienated them even more. When Morsi got into power, he was more sympathetic to their situation, and because they were more, a lot of them were Islamists, they had a better situation. They were not as alienated, and they weren't, wasn't the degree of political persecution that there was under Mubarak and that there is currently under the present government. And so when he was overthrown, they were very angry about it, as the Muslim Brotherhood supporters in the rest of the country. And now that the military is cracking down on them again, and they are, a lot of them are of extreme Islamists as well, they are now fighting each other again. And as I say, that's a situation that's just really difficult to control, because the Sinai is so open, it's so large, and it's so porous. And to just control that area completely, the Egyptian military is going to have to have huge resources there on a permanent basis.
Hmm. And, you know, speaking of which, is the support for the Muslim Brotherhood, is it very geographically centered? I mean, not just in the Sinai, but in other places in Egypt? Is it more, you know, the cities are the Democrats and out in the countries where the Republicans live sort of thing, like it is in the States? Or how does that work exactly? I mean, I know that they were the only ones prepared to win when it came to election time.
Yeah, it's kind of a breakdown, because although there were a lot of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood in Cairo, a lot of them who are educated, they tend to get more of their supporters from the rural people who are less educated, because about 60% more of the Egyptian population is illiterate. And in Upper East as well, there is strong support for the Muslim Brotherhood. So a large section of their supporters come from the more rural, illiterate, uneducated people. Although a lot of the leaders and the, you know, the intellectuals in Cairo are also supporting the Brotherhood, but they're more in they're more of a minority.
Hmm. Well, so now that the dictatorship is overthrown and outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood and rounded up all its leaders and all of that kind of thing, I mean, obviously we talked about the Sinai and the unrest there, but what about all those people in the countryside who were Muslim Brotherhood supporters? Are they just grinning and bearing it and back to the same old thing? Or is this, I mean, wouldn't it be horrible to see, after a couple of years since the overthrow of Mubarak, for this to now devolve into some kind of civil war? I mean, I don't guess the Muslim Brotherhood is very well armed, but it seems like, you know.
Well, the thing is that they're arresting people all over the country. I mean, thousands and thousands of people have been arrested, so it's not just happening in Cairo. And I mean, at the moment, it's a little bit quiet. I mean, in Cairo, there's been, you know, some protests by students at Al Azhar University, which is very pro-Muslim Brotherhood. But it's kind of quiet at the moment. But the Muslim Brotherhood is not going to let the situation lie. And I think their modus operandi is to, because what the Egyptian government now is trying to restore stability and say that the problems are over and the country's going to go back to normal. And the Muslim Brotherhood is not just going to let the situation lie. And I think they are trying to actually bring their supporters onto the street, because they actually do use the clashes and the results as a kind of a weapon to show that they're being persecuted, which they are to a large degree, but also, you know, that people don't forget what has happened to Morsi. And they're using the victimhood of all these people that have been killed, the Brotherhood people that were killed by the military, and that they are using that as a way of keeping their story alive, and, you know, not letting the situation lie. So they will try to, I think the leadership is a bit cynical in that way, and that they will try to get their supporters in the street to provoke clashes. I mean, one can argue quite justifiably that they have every right to be angry, and that what happened to Morsi was not right. But actually encouraging their supporters to go out into the streets and confront the military when they know what's going to happen is kind of cynical in a way.
Yeah, well, people ought to be careful whose marching orders they follow when it comes to stuff like that. Yeah, but yeah. You can see why it makes sense from their point of view to play it up for the cameras. You know, it's all they've got, right? Is the idea of some kind of outside pressure there, I guess. Well, now, so when it comes to... Oh, I'm sorry. Please go ahead. Did you have more to say there?
I'm not sure if the Muslim Brotherhood is, because they were involved in the 80s in actual, you know, attacks on tourists and that. I'm not sure if they're going to go underground and take up arms again. That's another aspect that has to be watched. It may happen. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, there has been, what, one big car bombing, right? And that had everybody biting their fingernails, like, oh no, maybe now is the start of this, but.
That wasn't by the Muslim Brotherhood, it was just by other groups, and there's been regular bombings in the Sinai against military targets, and of course some Christian targets as well, but that wasn't actually the Muslim Brotherhood.
By the way, back to the Sinai for a second there, is there any truth to the idea that it's Al-Qaeda guys there, because of course that's what the TV says, if they mention it at all?
As far as I know, yes, there are Al-Qaeda elements there. I mean, even in Gaza, there are some Al-Qaeda elements. This is the whole thing with the Libyan war. There are Al-Qaeda elements there. And in Mali, there are Al-Qaeda elements. And they are getting arms from Islamists in Libya. And the huge amount of arms that are now going from Libya to surrounding neighboring countries, you know, after Gaddafi's warehouses and that were looted. There definitely is elements of Al-Qaeda in the Sinai. I mean, they actually fly the Al-Qaeda flag. Or even if they're not directly linked to Al-Qaeda, they are groups with similar ideologies.
Yeah, sworn allegiances. Well, so a few years ago in the Gaza Strip, Hamas went and had a big battle and killed a bunch of these guys and said, no way, are we going to tolerate your presence in the Gaza Strip? What about that? Is that still happening?
They are still there, as Jaish al-Sunni and Sunni al-Islam. Those groups are still there, but they're basically being kept under control by Hamas. These groups are really, really radical.
Or don't give Netanyahu that excuse.
Sorry?
I was saying, don't give Netanyahu that excuse that, well, if Hamas can't keep these guys under control, we have to, something like that, you know?
Yeah. Hamas's security forces is keeping them under control because Hamas doesn't want another, you know, Israeli military operation against them, because these little groups tend to, the Egyptians are saying and the Israelis are saying, and I think there's some truth in what they're saying, that these radical elements in Gaza are actually cooperating with the radicals in the Sinai as well.
Mm. All right, well, I'm sorry that I got to stop you, but thank you very much for your time on the show, Mel. I sure do appreciate it. Good talk to you again.
Okay, thanks.
Everybody, that's Mel Freichberg. She writes for McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. They're syndicated all over the place. And you can find some stuff by her for IPSnews.net, too. We'll be right back with Mike Swanson right now. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. 3,000 archive, 3,000 interviews in my archive at scotthorton.org. And I don't mind being a sellout at all for this one. Mike Swanson, he's a sponsor of the show. And he's also the author of this incredible book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite, 1945 through 1963. Which, of course, I would read and interview him about, even if he wasn't an advertiser on the show. Because that's kind of my thing. Welcome back to the show, Mike. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's great to talk to you.
Very good to have you back. Let me mention real quick, of course, Wall Street Window is one of the primary sponsors of the show here, and that's your primary gig there, investment advice and all that. WallStreetWindow.com, people check that out. And then writer Michael Swanson is where they can find out all about this book. Of course, it's on Amazon.com. And I know you can get it in Kindle and paperback, but is a hardback out yet too or not, or what's the deal with that?
No, just paper and Kindle.
Okay. Well, hey, there ain't nothing wrong with that. I got the paperback
right here.
It's red, and it's got Ike on the front, and it's called The War State in big white letters, and you should get a bunch of them and pass them around. I was having fantasies as I was driving my truck that, wow, wouldn't it be nice if a bunch of people bought a whole bunch of these and started passing them around everywhere, like brought two copies down to their local library branch and said, hey, I just want to make sure you guys had a couple of copies of this. And just kind of, you know, I don't know, had their kid bring one to the junior high school where he goes for seventh grade or whatever, and leave these things around and get this thing out. I actually, Mike, I read this kind of ridiculous elitist thing in the Washington Post about Glenn Greenwald and his new media project, where he talked about the importance of organs like the Washington Post in deciding which facts people need to pay attention to or not, and which, actual facts become known truths out in the society and all that. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Only I want this book, instead of the Washington Post, to be the one that's doing the delivering of the information that everybody is supposed to just know. What's wrong with America? Empire's what's wrong with America. What's wrong with the economy? The whole thing is raped and perverted by the Pentagon is what's wrong with the economy, etc., etc., and just have everyone agree. It's so obviously true for anyone who dares to revise history at all. What happened? Well, World War II happened, and then the reason that was the last time we declared war is because we never stopped warring since. Simple as that. Ain't that right?
Yeah, it really is that simple. And the problem, I think, with the American people and the public at large is that when we just don't know any history. And all we think about are, like, individual events, like the Vietnam War, or Afghanistan, or Iraq, or 9/11. And then the government responds to these things, but nothing is ever put in any larger context. And people don't know the larger context, which is simple. It's that we're in a permanent war economy, and we have an empire, and that's as simple as that.
And yes, it's true. This is what I fantasize about: people passing out books. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean that's how we learn. I wish they would do it.
God, but people would pass this thing out. It's really great. I really love it, and it's a great read. And you know what? I'll go ahead and say this too. I strongly discourage people from fighting with their family about politics, and especially if you become a hardcore anti-war libertarian type, then you might realize you believe vastly different things than the rest of your family. And the thing is, family is the most important thing, and politics is not even a second place behind family. So, I wouldn't encourage people to, get into it. I mean, if they can talk politics nicely with their family, that's cool. But if people are getting into too heated of discussions, I would say just drop it and don't argue about it. However, if your mom or your dad, they're kind of interested in your crazy new point of view that you got here with your self there that you think is so right that you're always talking about, this is the kind of thing that you could give to them. This is for somebody's mom. This is the war state. Here's why America is all screwed up. It's pretty simple. Here's the answer. It's a red book with Ike on the front there, and simple as that. I think this could be one of those. You know, this is the kind of thing that, I mentioned the junior high school kid, the proverbial junior high school kid bringing it to class. I think this would be good for his teacher, you know?
Oh, I think so, too. And the thing about the book, one thing I did is after I wrote it, I had some test readers that don't know me, and I don't know them. I just got on a website called Elance where you can just hire people to do small jobs or something. Mm-hmm. So I put an ad on there, and I said, I want, if you're in the military, I want you to read this book and give me your opinion of it. And I had like five people in the armed forces read it, and all of them liked it. You know, not I've only had one person disagree with the book, and that's someone posted a negative review on Amazon, and you could tell they hadn't even read it. So it's real interesting that, you know, the basic facts in the book are, you know, I don't think they're really that controversial. It's just a matter that I've tied them all together with this theme that that the government has become or became this, you know, the phrase I use is a war state, and that's not something that's in people's consciousness, but the basic facts in the book and the way they're presented, it's hard to argue against them. Mm-hmm. The pro-war person could simply say, oh, yeah, all this is true, but it's just simply necessary.
Well, look, it's a common joke on this show, as I'm sure you're well aware, about how, hey, at least the Soviet Union existed, when we're talking about, you know, Bush's Islamo-fascist caliphate that we're supposedly at war with, which never existed outside of bin Laden's attic in Pakistan, where he is hiding in cowardly terror. And somehow this is the, you know, the giant, you know, the next superpower that we have to defend ourselves from. And yet, you know, hey, go look at an old globe. The USSR was a third of the surface of the earth or something, maybe even including the oceans. It's huge. It was a horrible, evil, totalitarian empire, and they did rule Eastern Europe, and they were, hey, right up on the border of all our democratic friends and allies in Western Europe. And Mike, you must be some kind of commie that you just refuse to accept the reality of the danger of a Stalin-led Soviet empire that absolutely had to be contained, even if it meant hiring the Dulles brothers to do the containing. Come on, man. How was that?
Actually,
pretty good, huh?
I tend to agree with the basic premise there, and that is, you know, after World War II, the world did split in this bipolar system in the United States and the Soviet Union, and the advisors under Truman saw the Soviet Union as a threat towards the end of World War II, and it wasn't because they thought the Soviet Union was going to invade the United States or start a new war or something, although some people would say that, but that was mostly just propaganda. What they were really afraid of was that we had all these colonial systems that disintegrated after the war. You know, England had colonies in India and Egypt and then all over the world, and over the next 10, 20 years, that was, the whole colonial system fell apart. France had parts of Africa and Indochina and so forth. And so there's this huge power vacuum that the United States was filling, and so was the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. But the people in Washington saw a potential threat from the Soviet Union because all of Europe had been devastated by World War II and basically in an economic collapse, totally bombed out. And there is a fear that what will happen is that there's a collapse after World War One and in the 30s, and they were scared that communism with the Soviet Union could send agents in these countries and turn them and take advantage of this. So they supported the Marshall Plan and rebuilt Europe. But I tend to think that was an intelligent thing to do. But if you look at the person that became the intellectual author of that policy, George Kennan, he claims that by 1949, 1950, the Soviet Union was successfully contained and that we could have actually negotiated with them or you know, really didn't have to do much more. But instead, Dean Acheson and some advisors around Truman decided that they didn't want to merely contain the Soviet Union. They wanted to defeat it and make it surrender. So they started this giant arms race, and they also turned a policy of simply containing the Soviet Union into one that became basically a policy of trying to control the whole world. And he put that policy on paper in this document, NSC-68, which stated that even if the Soviet Union didn't exist, we would have a problem of a threat of any disorder anywhere in the world. And the United States looked on any country and had to say, it's got to be our ally. It can't, if it's independent, then there's a danger it'll flip to the Soviets. So that, you know, justified interfering all over the world. And I think even today, even though the Soviet Union doesn't exist and now we have this so-called war on terror, there's a lot of similarities in the sense that back then, communism became a justification for interfering in countries such as Iran or Guatemala. As you mentioned, the Dulles brothers were doing that in the 50s. And today, it's, you know, communism is not a threat, but it's terrorism. So terrorism has now kind of replaced it as the boogeyman and is being used as a reason to try to maintain order basically all over the world. It's pretty much a continuum.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got the great quote in here, and I wish I'd bookmarked it. I'm flipping through trying to find it now. But it's such an important part of history, and I think mostly goes unnoticed. And as you say, and I wasn't, I guess, aware of this, but at the time of the passage of the National Security Act of 1947, the part about the establishment of the CIA went unnoticed and undebated at the time. They argued all about the formation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the spinning off of the Air Force and the creation of the National Security Council. But the CIA, what was that? That came out. People started paying attention to that after. But then there's this beautiful little quote there where, here it is. To perform, let's see, it gave the CIA the power, quote, to perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting the national security as the National Security Council may from time to time direct. In other words, which is just, it's such a great little newspeak way of saying, the president can authorize this agency to break the law, to do whatever he wants anywhere in the world without limit. He must only justify it to himself. And go ahead, Scrappy, get him.
Yeah, it is quite amazing when you look back to that document, that paragraph in that document is so innocuous. And when that bill, the bill that paragraph is in, created the Defense Department, it reorganized the branches of armed services, so there wasn't an Air Force until that bill was passed. And at the time, that's what everyone was arguing about. Are we going to have an Air Force? Are we going to do this? Or there was an argument to unify the armed services that got shot down. So this was a huge debate in Congress on all these other issues. And that one little couple lines, which was used to create the CIA, was inserted in there. And what's interesting is that Truman, as World War II came to an end, he made the statement that he didn't even want anything like what we think of the CIA to be created. There was an organization called the Office of Strategic Services during World War II that engaged in covert action, mainly in Europe, a little bit in Asia. And Alan Dulles, who became the director of the CIA in the 50s, he was running the OSS operations in Europe in Switzerland, talking to German officers and just trying to gather intelligence and do whatnot. And he had a vision of becoming the director of some giant new intelligence organization. But the guy that was over him and in charge of the OSS had the same idea, and he wanted to be the leader of it too. And he tried to meet with Truman to set the future of intelligence because this OSS thing was going to be disbanded. And Truman wouldn't even meet with them. Truman told him, told an associate that I don't want anything like this because it'll become an American Gestapo. And the war's over, we don't need this. So it's not really clear what, if Truman ever wanted anything like the CIA to come into existence. He suggested that he needed some sort of intelligence unit that could talk to him and tell him what's going on because during the war, there wasn't just the OSS. You got the FBI, you got military intelligence, all these different intelligence outfits. Mm-hmm. And you need like a coordinating agency that can tell the president what all these different people are saying. And it's clear he wanted that. And George Kennan, actually, with Alan Dulles, are the two main characters who created the law in there to create the CIA. And then George Kennan said this was a giant mistake, like the biggest mistake of his life a couple years later.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then didn't Truman end up writing an essay for the Washington Post right after the Kennedy assassination saying that this thing has gone way out of control, it's not what I ever intended when I signed it kind of a thing?
Yeah, he put this editorial in the Washington Post, I think it was a month to the day, I think, you know, after the Kennedy assassination, saying that it had taken on a life of its own and it's become something that's creating policies and needed to be changed or put back under
control. You think he meant something by that? He was kind of making a little mark for history there that he was telling you who fired that shot?
Some people speculate that, but I don't know.
All right, hang on 1 second. We'll be right back, everybody, with writer Michael Swanson, writermichaelswanson.com. He's the author of The War State. And, of course, also check him out at wallstreetwindow.com. We'll be right back after this.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Full interview archive at scotthorton.org. And this will be part two of my interview of Michael Swanson, writermichaelswanson.com. The book is The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite, 1945 through 1963. And so, you know, there's a whole new book out about the Dulles brothers. So they'll be important to talk about here. But I was kind of hoping that maybe, well, because, you know, time's somewhat limited. I don't know. You plan it out however you want to answer. But I also want to hear about Robert Taft, because I think he's a great story of what might have been, and to show that maybe just because history all happened before we were born doesn't mean it had to be the way that it is now that we're looking back on it, sort of a situation, you know? And you do a good job of telling the story of Robert Taft, who he was and what he was about. And I think, you know, most Americans probably don't even know, Mike, that there's an anti-war right. In fact, the anti-war was always the conservatives. It's always the liberal do-gooders out changing the world up until Vietnam, when the enemy was a left-wing enemy, and then the protesters ended up being, you know, young and all of that, and the new left, and then the role switched. But anyway, so teach him about Bob Taft, and then get into the Dulles brothers too, and we still got half an hour to go, so we'll talk about the rise of the CIA and some of their coups and revolutions, and Ike's nuclear policy and all this stuff. Mike Swanson, so say whatever you want now.
Sure. Well, okay, Robert Taft was a U.S. senator from Ohio that ran for president and came close to winning when Eisenhower ran. The two of them were running for the nomination, and Taft was a person who was against he was basically what we would think of as a libertarian. He probably is the most libertarian Republican besides Ron Paul, and came very close to winning. And one thing that's interesting about him, if you look at him and these Dulles brothers, they had actually very similar backgrounds, because the Dulles brothers and Taft were born into what you would think of as the very, very elite of American society. They all, I know Taft went to Yale. Taft was in Skull and Bones. And I don't think the Dulles brothers went to Yale, but they're, you know, I mean, if you go into Skull and Bones, you're at the top of the elite, you could say. And both of them, during World War One, went to Versailles during the peace negotiations. Alan Dulles went over there acting as something like a spy. John Foster Dulles, his uncle, was Robert Lansing, who is Wilson's Secretary of State. And Taft went over there with Herbert Hoover, who is running relief operations in Europe. So, I mean, these are young people just out of college doing these kind of things. I mean, I don't know anyone with those, myself with that kind of background. You could be in their 20s and running around with future presidents and secretaries of state and so forth. And they all know each other. In fact, Taft married a woman that actually was courted by John Foster Dulles. So, you know, they're friends throughout their whole lives. So what's interesting, though, is that they take different views when it comes to foreign policy as they get older. And I think it has to do with their background. The Dulles brothers went into corporate law on Wall Street and joined this firm called Sullivan Cromwell, which was the premier law firm for American corporations. It had put together the deal for the Panama Canal, the U.S. Steel Trust, and they, you know, they, Alan Dulles went to Europe in the 20s and 30s and did business deals over there. So these are people on the peak of Wall Street corporations and operations and so forth. And Taft did something different. He moved back to Ohio and became a big city lawyer and did business with his brother-in-law, who had a large companies and operations in the United States. But he mainly dealt with business people that weren't international corporations, the regular people. So I think that gave him a different outlook on government and in life in general. So where the Dulles brothers were exponents of empire, you can say, and international trade and the United States having a big role in the world and covert operations and all this kind of business, Taft was always someone that was more libertarian-orientated, who feared, his biggest fear was that the government would grow in size and that would lead to higher taxes, more inflation, and centralized power in the executive branch, which all these things would be a threat to liberty. And I think that's, of course, exactly what has happened. So I see him as someone who was a prophet of the future. And
was smeared and red-baited by the nation.
That's right. And they called him an isolationist and
Mr. Republican, he can't face up to the dangers of the Red Menace, I guess. Why would he be concerned about such a thing as that?
Well, he wasn't just a Republican. He was the most important Republican in the Republican Party in the early 1940s and in the late 30s. He was basically the face of opposition to the New Deal. And he wasn't like one of these Southern you know, racists or rednecks or whatever you want to call them. He was a mainstream guy, and the Republican Party was split in two, and he was the leader of small government libertarian opposition to the New Deal, mostly based in the Midwest, not in the South, because at the time the South was controlled by the Democratic Party. It's not the Democratic Party today. It was a Southern Democratic Party. So Taft's allies are mostly in the Midwest, and then the other half of the Republican Party was basically led by Wendell Willkie, who was based in New York with what you would call the Eastern establishment Republicans. And those were people like the Dulles brothers. They were actually very close to him, and they helped manage his campaign. Mm-hmm. And he tried to run for president against, I think it was Truman, and he lost. And then he was rumbling to do it again in the election of Stevenson Eisenhower.
All right, well, I'm sorry, we got to go because we got music coming up. But we'll be right back to talk about that, because it's interesting how they stole the nomination from Taft. And, well, anyway, the rise of NATO and then Ike as Taft Light, sort of? I don't know. Hold tight. We'll be right back after this with Mike Swanson, The War State. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
Oops, bad timing on that one. I wonder if it's going to kick on at all. Oh, well. Sorry, I screwed that up, guys, but I'll go ahead and pick it up from here. TheBumperSticker.com at TheBumperSticker.com. They'll print stuff for you, for your band, your business, things that you need stickers for. And, of course, Why Peace is an excellent book. Sorry to compete with you, Mike, but, or, you know, air your competition. But Why Peace, it's awesome. It's a great compendium of anti-war activists, heavily weighted toward libertarians and from the past decade. And I should be in there. I'm in the introduction, but I blew it. I should have written a thing for that. But anyway, get Why Peace, read Why Peace, get lots of copies of it, pass them around, make sure your local librarian has a couple. All right. I mean that, too. I mean, it's really something special, that book. It's great. Okay, so we're talking with Michael Swanson. He's the author of The War State, and this will be part two of his interview, and I think there will probably be four, maybe five, before we're done getting through all the topics in this book and the way I want to cover them best we can here. But so we've talked about Robert Taft, Mr. Republican, the conservative, anti-Cold Warrior, or somewhat Cold Warrior. I don't know how to characterize it. I'll turn that back over to Mike here in a second. But then, of course, there's the rise of the Dulles brothers, lawyers for the Rockefellers, basically. One became the Secretary of State. John Foster became the Secretary of State. His brother Alan became the head of the CIA. And in the Ike years, boy, they went to work. And so then, on the other hand, you do sort of portray Ike Eisenhower as a little bit of a half of Robert Taft, if not, you know, I mean, I guess he wasn't from Connecticut like the Bushes or something, was he?
Well, basically, what kind of happened is in that election, you had Robert Taft, and then it looked like he was going to get the nomination. And he wasn't, he wasn't an isolationist, or even if you take a look at Ron Paul today, Ron Paul would talk about bringing everyone back home and dismantling the national security state or whatever. And that's nothing, Taft never said anything like that. Taft's argument was, we've got to have a balanced budget. Truman went to Korea without declaring war. We can't, you know, we got to follow the Constitution. We've got to have a balanced budget. And all we need to do is have a small military or a smaller military budget and just fund nuclear bombers, and that's all we got to do to be safe. So we don't need to be, we don't even necessarily even need NATO. And essentially what happened was people around Wendell Willkie feared that if Taft won, they'd lose control of the Republican Party. And then people, let's say the Council for Foreign Relations Group or the Dulles brothers, did not like Taft's ideas either. And they searched out a candidate that they knew would beat him, and got Eisenhower to run. And Eisenhower is kind of like a blank slate, a military hero to the American people, or he was a hero. And they got him to run, and he took the nomination away from Taft and became the president. When he served as president, he essentially gave Allen Dulles, who rose now to become head of the CIA, a blank check. It basically allowed him to do anything he wanted. But Eisenhower was concerned, too, with having a budget that's under control. He also feared that deficits would lead to higher taxes, inflation, and harm the economy and lead to a garrison state. So he shared those same sort of concerns that Taft did when it came to the amount of money the government spent. But he gave Dulles a blank check because he thought that the CIA operations that Allen Dulles launched in various countries, Iran, Guatemala being the most famous, were cheap and they didn't cost anything. You know, it only cost about $10 million to overthrow Iran and probably a similar amount in Guatemala. The problem is, of course, that we're living with the results of those operations today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they cost a lot more than $10 million, but that's another story.
Right. Well, I mean, no, it isn't. It's the story. In fact, like Chalmers Johnson pointed out, I believe that the term blowback comes from CIA documents surrounding the coup in Iran. That, yeah, this worked well, but we're going to have some blowback coming down the line.
And there was a bit of a, you know, it's a strange story because Eisenhower, he gave these guys a blank check, or he gave Allen Dulles a blank check, but he didn't trust them either. He commissioned a study. He did this twice. He asked people to investigate what Allen Dulles was doing and then, you know, make a report about it. And two different times, they basically told him that he's incompetent, that he's pretending to have these great successes when most of the things are failures. He's got Iran and Guatemala, but that's it. And he's spreading lots of lies about what he's doing, and everyone below him's incompetent, and he doesn't even know what's going on himself. And you know, despite the examples of Iran and Guatemala, if you look, almost everything the CIA did was a disaster. Those are disasters too, but they didn't even succeed in what they were trying to do in their operations. One of the most famous examples of that is right at the beginning of the creation of the CIA and they're running these operations. The guy in charge was someone named Frank Wisner, who ironically his son became a go-between just the other year between the United States and these generals in Egypt. That's how this stuff gets passed down. But he had been in the OSS, and he ascended to become one of the top people in the CIA, and he was running these covert operations in Eastern Europe, where he would get refugees after World War II and try to get them to go behind the Iron Curtain and infiltrate and, you know, take some arms or something and prepare in case there's World War III, and they'd pop up and become an insurgency. And all these people would end up getting caught. And he sent people into China doing this. And I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but I think it was like 100 people or so. And every single one of them got caught. And this guy ends up Frank Wisner ends up getting depressed and kills himself. So that's the kind of stuff that was going on in the CIA operations, and then you got Alan Dulles basically going to cocktail parties and hobnobbing with people and acting like he's, you know, some sort of genius or something.
Well, you know, when all your failures are classified, I guess you get to do that, right?
Exactly.
Makes it easy. All right, now, so let's talk about this new look policy of Eisenhower's. You really focus on, and I guess it's really important, huh, that this guy really liked playing cards, and he figured everybody else was just playing cards too, and so what he would do is he would have the government build 18,000 nuclear bombs, and then that way he could be a small government conservative on the militarism issue. He would just have 18,000 nuclear bombs, and then that way China and Russia at the very least would mess with us, and probably most of the time would do what we wanted to, or certainly in the case of China a couple times that you detail there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What happened was, if you look at Eisenhower's background, he was not, you know, a dumb person by any stretch of the imagination, despite, you know, what I made it sound like he was doing with the Dulles brothers. This was a man with tremendous experience in the war. I mean, you don't manage the D-Day invasion and the alliance without, you know, becoming a great politician. And he kind of hid his political savvy when he was president by playing golf and not really giving any, trying not to give, you know, any opinions or rock the boat or, you know, say as little as possible to the American people and just be calm all the time. But behind the scenes, you know, all sorts of stuff was going on. And one of his big interests was managing the armed forces in the military. And he actually advised Truman when he was president, then he becomes president. But his big issue was he feared that in the armed services there would be inter-service rivalry where each branch of the military would want its own budget and they would compete with each other for their own importance, and that would lead to wasteful spending and redundancy, which is all true. But he wanted to fight that and try to control military spending and not let everything go nuts. So he came up with this policy of focusing on the nuclear forces, nuclear bombers, and the development of nuclear missiles, with the idea that, well, we can't afford to compete with the Soviet Union in Europe with conventional forces because they're there and we're all across the ocean. So if there was a real war, how are we going to send everyone over there? Just like the Russians can't, you know, they're not going to bring an invasion fleet over here. And the service chiefs, the Army and the Navy, you know, they would want to try to do it, but he just said, well, that's impossible. So we will focus on the development of nuclear weapons. And then to justify that, he comes up with this new look policy, which states that he makes the statement that we're going to treat nuclear weapons as any other weapon, implying that, you know, we won't hesitate to use them if our interests are threatened. So he makes a bluff against China. What happened there is Taiwan, there was a Chinese civil war between Chiang Kai-shek and the communists. The communists win. Chiang flees to Taiwan and creates a military dictatorship there. And China's sitting there, and they're both threatening each other and so forth. China starts to shell these two little islands that no one's living on them, but they're trying to make a show of force that are part of Taiwan. And Eisenhower basically says that if this continues or if you invade Taiwan, he hints that we'll use nuclear weapons, and China backs down. They don't have any nuclear weapons, so they can't engage in some sort of fight like that. And that's the most well-known use of that policy. But what ends up happening is that these new look policies create critics inside the military. The Air Force loves it, but the Army doesn't in particular, and they start to make leaks. Different generals make leaks to the press that this policy can endanger national security. It's not preparing us for wars that are more likely. We're not likely to have a nuclear war. We're more likely to have a smaller conflict, and this policy really isn't workable. And there's a movement to try to increase the military budget beyond what Eisenhower even wants, and that's pretty much allied with the Army. So to try to control these people, Eisenhower holds a study of he commissions a secret study that's just for the White House about what are the Soviet capabilities, what are our capabilities, and he's expecting this study to kind of, you know, help him out politically. And what ends up happening is the same guy that essentially did the legwork for this NSC 68, his name is Paul Nitz, he is the guy behind this study too, and he doesn't really have any hard information one way or the other, but he claims that the Soviet Union is going to build all these nuclear missiles in the next couple years, I think it's by 1960, 1961, overtake the United States, put us in a huge strategic disadvantage, and would have the capability to launch a first strike and wipe us all out. Well, it's all pretty much made up. In a draft Paul Nitz made of this document, there's paragraphs where he writes, is this real? Who knows? You know, they don't even care. They just want an argument for what they want. And when they present this report to Eisenhower, Eisenhower gets very angry at him and basically cusses him out the room. So then Nitz leaks this to the press, and they've got all kinds of allies in Congress who now start attacking Eisenhower as being soft on defense, and the Democratic Party attacks him. When Kennedy runs for president, this is the basis of the missile gap, and the whole thing is basically a giant fraud. So as Eisenhower finally ends his presidency, he's kind of in a fit of anger, and he holds National Security Council meetings, his final one. He tells the people there that if this type of talk continues, if the military budget keeps growing, and what we're facing is a problem with special interests in a democracy, can we have a democracy and these special interests in the military, and are we going to be able to continue on this road? How could we do this and face the Soviet threat? What's the future of our country? And then the result of these thoughts is his famous farewell address. So that address he gives is basically a result of being criticized by the Democratic Party and interests in the military-industrial complex that claim he's soft on defense, even though he has built so many nuclear missiles and bombs that it's pretty much unimaginable. And he knows he has the real intelligence, too, of what the Russian capabilities are. He's commissioned U-2 spy planes to fly over the Soviet Union and take pictures, and he knows they basically have nothing. They don't even have a nuclear missile that can reach the United States until Kennedy's president.
Well, and you know, that is just so instructive, too, to think Ike Eisenhower, who, you know, single-handedly defeated Nazism, who was the great American hero, and you like Ike, and I like Ike, and we like Ike, and everybody likes Ike, and what a personality he was. I mean, I guess they sort of lampooned him as a little bit George W. Bushy in the brain at the time or something like that, but I mean, what I'm getting at is this is a guy who had a lot of political capital when it came to respect from the American people, and especially, you know, if it came to the kind of thing where he wanted to pick a fight with other forces inside the government. In fact, you even talk about he gave a speech directly to the American people going, hey, look, this is the budget. This is important. So you have to take my side on this. And they did. But it was everything this guy could do to try Ike Eisenhower, super president or something, you know, 10 feet tall. It was everything he could do to try to restrain the power of this military-industrial complex. And the way you put it, like, he, by the time he gave that speech on the way out the door in 1960, he was mad as hell. And that was his kind of fighting back that, well, at least I'm going to tell everybody about who you guys are and what you're up to and how they ought to not trust you and whatever. But that was after 8 years of really, I mean, I guess partially succeeding in stopping them in some ways, but I don't know. It sure was a pretty big world empire he was passing off to JFK by the time he left complaining about it.
Yeah, it's tough. What is it? It's a good question. What is his ultimate legacy when it comes to? I mean, he gives this famous speech. That's what we all remember him for. That's what's on the cover of my book, and you know, it's one of the most recognizable events of the 50s. But when you really look at it, I mean, he engaged in an arms race. He did increase the military budget, and he didn't give them as much as they wanted. He had to fight them to do what he did, but what he did by escalating the arms race, I think, leads to some very dangerous situations in the 1960s. We'll get to that later. The Cuban Missile Crisis, and I think the Vietnam War all originated in this giant arms race that he basically created. And of course, we have the legacy of these covert operations in these different countries that he wholeheartedly supported. So, you know, it is amazing. My thinking is that, you know, my whole book is basically the notion is that this war state came into being and our government fundamentally changed the system of government with the creation of this national security state, this military-industrial complex. And by power elite, I mean the politicians and bureaucrats and business people that are all linked up to that. But the thing is that I think this was a gradual transformation that basically was completed by the time Eisenhower gave that speech. And I think everything that has come after that speech is essentially, the effects of this creation that we're living with today.
Right, I mean, that's the funny thing it's hard sometimes to understand that, the corruption is not just, you know, like I see prison abuse stories and people say, well, you know, privatized prisons. Well, you know, there were already problems with the prisons before they were all privatized. As bad as that is, it's not the root of the problem. The problem is the state and a director. I mean, think of somebody like J. Edgar Hoover, right? What did he need with millions and millions of dollars? He had all the power in the world, right? He had blackmail on every congressman and senator and everybody they were related to, too, and whatever he wanted. So, and that was back in the old days before it was all high-tech the way it is now. And so that's the thing about it. Like Anthony Gregory says, Barack Obama, you know, if you ask the liberal lefties who they all hate, they might point at a banker or Lockheed or something if they're smart, but Barack Obama's the only real trillionaire in the world. And look what he does with it. You know, it's actually the state agencies themselves, the Pentagon first and foremost among them, the CIA second, I guess, who they're the ones with all the power. What do they even need with money? That's all the money's good for anyway, is power.
Yeah, that's one thing about this history or the topic is how do you interpret all this stuff? And there's basically two schools of thought. In one would say, if you take the Dulles brothers as an example, that these people are essentially representatives of big business, that everything they're doing is on the behalf of their business clients and their business interests, and it's all about making more money. However, I don't really think in the end that that's true at all. But yeah, sure, there is corruption, but I think that corruption is just a mechanism for them to have more personal power, and that's what these people are really about. And if you take, you know, these generals in the military or, you know, someone that's a lower level in the CIA or something, they're not in it for money. They believe they're doing the right thing, and I think that's real critical. These opponents are critics of Eisenhower, they believed in what they were saying. And a great example of how this kind of works is the debates over the military budget. What would happen is, you know, every time there'd be a military budget, the Army would say, well, look, we're the most important force. We're not going to have a nuclear war. We need flexible response and come up with tactics to do conventional wars. And Air Force would say, oh, we got to have nuclear weapons. And then, to make a long story short, every branch of the armed services would come up with justifications for their own increasing power and importance. And the people advocating them believed the stuff, you know. It was like they believed what was in their own best interest, not simply because they were greedy or something, but, you know, they rationalized all this stuff and thought they were right.
Yeah. Well, you know, as simple as it is, I think that's really the bottom line that is hard for people to accept. And I only think just based on my own experience where, you know, especially if you go to government school around, you're taught that ultimately all this is decided by the democracy, which means the majority of the people. And how could they all be wrong? Or how could the majority of the people be wrong? At least most of the time, they do it right. And so this is the way it is because this is the way people want it to be. It's the ultimate legitimacy, you know? It's better even than being sanctified by God, really. It's sanctified by you. Even if you voted no this time, you still love it, kind of, you know?
Well, the thing about all this, these policies, this history, NSC 68, which I think basically was a document justifying the United States becoming an empire. We talk about the New Look policy or the creation of the CIA, a couple lines in a bill, essentially. None of these things are voted on by the American people. The American people, in fact, didn't know anything about them. Well, they wouldn't have known about the New Look, but the other two things weren't really reported in the newspaper. NSC 68 was classified to the 70s. So all these decisions are made essentially in secret. You know, we didn't know anything about Guatemala or Iran or any of this stuff. It's not decided upon by voters. All we get to vote on is one or two candidates that are picked for us, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, I mean, it really is. It's still hard for me to wrap my mind around the idea of nuclear weapons lobbyists, you know, in or outside of government, the guys that are working for the companies, the contractors that make the hydrogen bombs, or, you know, their liaisons within the Pentagon and the different generals and colonels and whoever competing for power inside those divisions of the different branches and whatever. It just, you know, only because I really want to, Michael, I like believing that, oh, no, they're professional, competent men in charge of those nukes and in charge of the policy, too, because how could it be otherwise? You know, how could anyone say that, you know, START 2, I'll be damned if you're going to pass START 2, not without a bunch of writers that give me a bunch more money to make more nukes. I mean, how could it be that anyone, I mean, they could get other jobs, especially if they're so brilliant they're making nuclear bombs for a living. Like, geez, what if the policy was we didn't want to have nukes anymore? But no, they insist because that's their livelihood. So, I mean, that kind of thing to me is, I want to not believe it. It's too obviously true, but it's no different than lobbyists for any other cause in America, for any other special interest in America, the nuke lobby. And in fact, like, who the hell was in charge of deciding we needed 18,000 of these things in the first place? They couldn't threaten communism with less than 18,000 nukes, Mike? I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, especially if you're talking about the 1950s, they, like I said again, they did not have the capability to even attack the United States. It wasn't until like 56 or 57 that the Soviets had a nuclear rocket, and all it was an upgraded V-2 rocket, which is what the Germans were shooting during World War II in England. They just upgraded it so they could reach Europe or parts of it. So it's completely amazing when you think of it like that. I mean, and Eisenhower tried to negotiate. Actually, he made an attempt to negotiate with the Russians and try to end actually the arms race in the Cold War. He reached out to them, and then as soon as he did it, the U-2 plane exploded over the Soviet Union, and Khrushchev then had he had to face his own hardliners. So it's the hardliners on both sides kind of fed off each other.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first I ever heard of that was a conspiracy theory about when I was a little kid that the CIA deliberately got him shot down to scuttle those talks representing corrupt interests in the Cold War. I don't know if you have an opinion about that. In fact, we're out of time. Maybe we'll start with, what was his name? Gary Powers, right? Start with the U2 flight next time on the show. Thank you very much, Mike Swanson. Sorry to end your interview with that ridiculous thing.
Oh, no problem.
I don't know. All right, Michael Swanson, The War State, writer MichaelSwanson.com and WallStreetWindow.com, of course. Thanks very much. See y'all tomorrow.